Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
Hello and welcome to Late Night Live. I'm Mark Colvin. On the programme tonight, the shifting boundaries of race. Old racist ideas about mixing blood have had an enormous influence on American life, and the Obama presidency in some ways has just refocused them. I'll be talking to an author whose book explores what he calls the invisible line between black and white through the fascinating stories of three American families. But my first guest, Francis Fukuyama, ignited a global debate with his best-selling book, The End of History and The Last Man. That was two decades ago. He's written several books since in what's been a fascinating journey. Once classified among the Bush-era neoconservatives, he's changed and radically developed his thinking. We've invited him on the program to discuss his latest big book, The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. It's about where civilized, transparent, democratic states come from. Why do some political institutions like Denmark succeed and others like Somalia or Haiti collapse? He describes Denmark as starting out with a tribal population ruled by ferocious Vikings. Today, this place, which we know from Norse legends, has become an example to the rest of the world. Free of corruption, good government, responsive, democratic, and with good services. So why can't Afghanistan or Somalia or Haiti or Iraq become like Denmark? One answer from Francis Fukuyama, because we don't really understand how Denmark itself got to be Denmark. Francis Fukuyama is the Oliver Nomellini Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spolley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. He joins me from his home in California. Francis Fukuyama, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
What did you set out to, what was the overarching thrust of your book when you started it, and did it change as you wrote it?
Well, the writing of this book really originated in my interest in failed states as a policy issue. Obviously, this has been important for the international community in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Haiti, and it always seemed to me that we had this idea, this idealized picture of a Denmark-like place with strong governance that we were trying to turn these countries into. I actually spent a fair amount of time in Melanesia over the past a few years in places like Papua New Guinea and the Solomons, actually looking at the international efforts there. It did seem to me that we really did not have a good historical understanding of how difficult it is to create institutions and the degree to which they often are the product of contingent and almost accidental circumstances, and therefore we had wildly exaggerated expectations of what we could achieve in helping some of these states achieve a better level of governance. And so that's really one of the issues, I think, that motivated this.
You begin with, you call it pre-human, I guess prehistory, at that time when humanity came out of the Rift Valley. What characterized early human society?
Well, I think that the reason I begin with human nature and with primate behavior and very primitive societies is that I do believe there are natural forms of sociability, which biologists would describe, I think, in terms of two features. One is kin selection, that is to say, we favor genetic relatives. So nepotism is something we're all born with, or the tendency towards nepotism. And the other is reciprocal altruism, the exchanging of favors between people that meet on a face-to-face basis. And these are the default forms of human sociability. You don't have to teach children how to cooperate on this basis. And in a sense, human political institutions have to be built in some sense in opposition to these natural forms of sociability, because when we move to something like a state, we want not to favor friends and family. We want a state that treats citizens on a universal basis, that is impersonal, that doesn't show favoritism and the like.
On the other hand, we had on this program a couple of weeks ago, we had the authors of a book called Super Cooperators, which argues, it's a new argument about Darwin, really, and it argues that we're not just programmed to fight and to look after our own families, but there is cooperation built right into our DNA as well. So I suppose that may influence the argument.
Sure. Well, that is, in a sense, what this book is arguing. It's we obviously have the basis for much more complex forms of organization. So, for example, when we move from a band to a tribal level, it's on the basis of the worship of ancestors that may be dead several generations. And then when we move to more complex societies, state-level societies, oftentimes they're imbued with religious significance that, again, requires a very complex set of cognitive capacities to imagine deities and to invest institutions with that kind of religious significance. And I think you can trace a lot of this back to human nature, but a lot of this also only unfolds in historical time. It's not something that human beings come to immediately.
Let's go to China, because you have about six chapters on China, I think. And is China the first really organized state society?
Well, it's not the first state. You had states in Mesopotamia and Egypt and other places that predated the Chinese state. My argument is a little bit different. It's that China was the first society to develop a modern state. And by modern, I mean something that gets beyond just friends and family, that isn't based on recruiting the close kinsmen of the ruler, but actually treats citizens with some degree of impersonality. And I argue that in the Qin dynasty, which was the founding dynasty of the unified China in the 3rd century BC, the Chinese had already achieved this kind of state. They had invented the civil service examination. They promoted people based on merit. They organized a functional, rational bureaucracy of a sort that Europeans really didn't get to for another 1,800 years or so. And I think that this is an historical achievement on the part of the Chinese that people in the West have tended to overlook.
Well, did they come to that organically, or was it necessary first to have a very large number of wars?
Well, Charles Tilly, a social scientist at Columbia, argued about Europe that war made the state and the state makes war, that there's an intimate connection between the existential threat that military competition provides and the building of much more complex modern institutions. And this was exactly the scenario that unfolded in ancient China during what the Chinese called the spring and autumn periods and the warring states period, roughly from the 7th to the 3rd centuries B.C., the polities in China fought this unending series of very bloody wars, and they were forced, in a sense, to come to modern rational administration because they needed to raise taxes, they needed to have bureaucrats that could supply armies, and that was, as in Europe many centuries later, the real driver of the development of modern institutions.
It's fascinating, isn't it? The Chinese film industry is very fixated on this period, and clearly modern China, the government of modern China, is very interested in that idea of centralizing, creating an empire, and holding it all together through a central authority. It's in other words, what I'm saying is that this was 2,700 years ago, but it absolutely resonates in modern China.
Well, it does, and essentially their form of government isn't all that different. They're very good at a modern, rational, bureaucratic, centralized government. What didn't happen, however, in China is just as important, because I believe that China is really the only major society never to have developed anything like the rule of law. The rule of law, I think in its deepest sense, means that the community has a set of formal legal rules that everyone regards as higher than the will of the current government that happens to be running the country. If the emperor can just make up the rules as he goes along, then there's no rule of law. And you had such a religiously based rule of law in Israel, in the Christian West, in the world of Islam, in Hindu India, but China never had this because they never really developed a transcendental religion, and they didn't get past the level of ancestor worship. And so the emperors, Chinese emperors, were never bound by a rule of law, and I think that's a situation that really continues up to the present day. The Chinese Communist Party makes the constitution and not the other way around.
How did they get to a fully operative modern state, as you say, while maintaining ancestor worship, which is part of what you describe as tribalism, and which, in your view, retards states from becoming modern?
Well, it's a good question, because in other civilizations, you needed a much more universal kind of religion. For example, in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, early in the 7th century, declared this new religion in a way to unify the Arab tribes who were mired in tribal conflicts, in petty squabbles. They could never be they couldn't make anything of themselves militarily because they couldn't cooperate. And what the religion of Islam did was to give people a basis of community, what's called the Ummah, that transcended these tribal loyalties. Now, the Chinese managed to do this without the benefit of this kind of a transcendental religion, I think on the basis of in a sense, just sheer power and necessity. But it is a very interesting fact that religion has just never played the same kind of role. What you had instead was Confucianism, which was an ethical doctrine, but didn't have the same kind of spiritual significance that religion has played in other societies.
The Warring States period, as you say, from China, from that China emerged in a different form. Is that the paradox, that you have to have wars between what are essentially tribal armies to get where you want to?
Well, I think that it's an unfortunate and, in a sense, tragic feature of human nature and human history, that a great deal of historical progress in terms of the evolution of these higher forms of social organization have come about really as a result of competition, desperate competition. People on the left like the idea that humans are cooperative, and people on the right think that they're very competitive. And the truth of the matter is, I think in evolutionary terms, that the two sides, they're just the two sides of the same coin. That is to say, we learn to cooperate in order to compete as groups against other groups. And this is true at virtually every level of human social development. So that was true when tribes were first organized out of hunter-gatherer societies. It was true when the first state emerged against the background of tribalism, and it continues to be true today. If you look at the United States, the big growth of government in the U.S. was driven by the Civil War in the 1860s, and then by World War I and II and the Cold War. So up to this very moment, I think the growth of government is very much related to military competition.
What are the problems of tribal armies that make it desirable for a ruler or a government to move to a more central system?
Well, I think that, in a sense, all human beings, as I said, are by nature ready to fall back on kinship as a form of organization. One of the, I think, fascinating features of many different world civilizations is that even when you establish a modern state, meaning it's impersonal, it isn't based just on family and friends, the fact is that the human impulse to cooperate on that basis is so strong that any time the state shows weakness, in a sense, tribalism reinserts itself. So this happened to the Chinese in the 3rd century AD after the collapse of the Han Dynasty, when patrimonial elites basically reappropriated the state. It happened to old regime France in the 16th, 17th centuries when the French state actually had to sell off public offices to wealthy individuals, and you know, it happened in the Ottoman Empire and many other societies. And so, in a sense, tribalism, although not for, you know, obviously we no longer live in tribes, but that basic urge to deal with friends and family and to favor them is a constant. And you know, I think you see it in the U.S. Congress and modern legislatures. You know, that this kind of personalized dealing remains a very powerful impulse.
This is Late Night Live. I'm Mark Colvin. We're discussing Francis Fukuyama's new book, The Origins of Political Order, on Radio National. Before we move on from China, I do want you to talk about your favorite character, the evil Empress Wu.
Well, that's right. The evil Empress Wu was a fascinating character in her own right. She was early in the Tang Dynasty. So this is, you know, this is a good 1,300 years ago. She was the only female ever to establish a dynasty in her own name, as opposed to ruling as a regent through her son or her husband. And the reason that I spent a certain amount of time talking about her reign was that I think it illustrates the impact of the lack of the rule of law in China when you compare her rule to that of other powerful absolutist kings in, let's say, in Western Europe, because in the course of her rise, she managed to kill off the empress that, you know, was married to the emperor that whose concubine she was, had her chopped up and stuffed in a wine vat. She killed off all of the court retainers and rivals to power, and then went on something like a mad purge where she literally eliminated the bulk of the Tang aristocracy.
Quite Stalinist, really.
Very much like Stalin, and so you have this almost proto-totalitarian ability to, you know, to go after the persons of all the elite members of the society that's supporting your regime. And I think that it suggests that there actually was a lesser degree of constraint that existed in the absolutism that you could develop in a society like that of dynastic China. You compare that to Charles V, the great Habsburg Emperor, Louis XIV, who also faced aristocratic rebellions. In both of their cases, you know, when they put down the rebellion, they basically pardoned the rebels because they were protected by, you know, by law. And I think that's one of the, you know, the differences between political development in the West and political development in China.
You could argue, though, that Louis XIV's reign was followed not very long after, because he was succeeded by much weaker kings, followed by the French Revolution. Talk a bit about how that comes about and what the French Revolution means in your scheme of things.
Well, the problem in old regime France, as I said, was that, in a way we misunderstand what French absolutism was, because at the time, especially viewed through the eyes of an Englishman, the centralized monarchy of Louis XIV looked like this unbelievably strong bureaucratic empire. But in fact, it was rotten to the core because of this practice of venal office, that the king, as a result of prolonged wars on the continent or with Britain, was constantly broke. He constantly had to borrow money. He had no credit on the international financial markets, and as a result, he literally had to sell off public offices, so that by the time you get to the revolution, the entire French public administration is the private property of wealthy individuals. In fact, in the early 1600s, they developed an institution called the Paulette, by which a wealthy person who had purchased a noble title and a public office, like the tax collector for a particular city, could actually pass that on to his son as part of the son's inheritance, along with a chateau and lands and everything else. And what it did was to completely delegitimate the state in the eyes of everybody, and I think it laid the groundwork for the revolution itself.
And then the revolution turned into the terror, It's always that seems to be kind of recurring pattern, that it takes a very great deal to achieve a modern state. And yet you began by talking about Denmark. Of course, there was the Danegeld that was paid by the English, and they were marauders. I think a lot of the Vikings then became Normans and invaded England. But how does Denmark come to be the way it is today?
Well, Denmark, it's a lucky country, basically, because it succeeded in modernizing without the levels of violence that France or Russia or other countries have seen. Although, to be fair, if Bismarck hadn't taken the German provinces away from Denmark in the 1860s, Denmark wouldn't have gotten to be this nice, homogeneous, little country that it is today. But I think one, fascinating reason that the Danes developed so successfully was a byproduct, again, of religion. In the early 1500s, the Danish king accepted Lutheranism, and one of the things that the Lutherans wanted to do was to teach peasants to read, because they wanted them to read the Lesser Catechism and to be able to read the Bible without the intervention of a priest. And as a result, not just in Denmark, but in other parts of Scandinavia, by the end of the 18th century, you had an almost completely literate peasantry who could organize, who could get into much higher value-added kinds of farming. And they really became the backbone of the democratic movement when Denmark finally turned to a formal democracy in the 19th century. So it's very remarkable. The Lutherans didn't plan that the conversion of the country to Protestantism would have these major political effects down the road, but indeed they did, and I think that shows the kind of accidental nature of historical development.
If you look at the Arab Spring, as it's called, which countries would you think? I mean, we think of Somalia, not that that's part of the Arab Spring, but if we think about Libya, and then we look at Tunisia next door, is one more likely to succeed than the other? Has Egypt got institutions which, in your terms, are more likely to make it eventually become a stable state?
Well, I think both Tunisia and Egypt have a big advantage over countries like Libya, Syria, Yemen, and so forth, just because they've got strong national identities already. Tunisia is relatively small and relatively homogeneous. Egypt obviously has had a history of statehood, independent statehood, for thousands of years, and so they're not this collection of what's called tribes with flags, the way the Libyans are or the Syrians, who are they're ruled by a minority group, the Alawites, and there's plenty of tribal conflicts that afflict all of these other countries. And
are they likely to go the way of the Balkans?
Well, it's entirely possible. It's really the Italians that created modern Libya by forcing together Tripoli and Benghazi into a single country that had really not existed prior to that. In Yemen, there's now with President Saleh, who's been assassination attempt has been made against him. It's not really a democratic movement, clearly, that's opposing him. It's really a tribal rivalry, and that means that the conflict is likely to go on in the absence of an overarching national identity that really won't have anything to do with democracy versus authoritarianism. It'll just be a fight among these different internal groups for who gets to run the country and have access to its assets. So I think that those countries without strong national identities are really going to have trouble in making any kind of a transition to real democracy.
If you look, I mean, the book stops at the French Revolution, but if you look through the focus that you've established at the modern-day United States, it's a country of laws. Famously, it has the Constitution, which gives you the executive, the parliament, as it were, and the judiciary. Is the United States in a good position, or are things starting to fall to pieces, as some people believe?
Well, I believe that any political system can undergo decay for a number of reasons. If the institutions are too rigid, if people's ideas aren't flexible enough, then a set of institutions created to meet one set of circumstances may not adjust when the circumstances change. And I think to some extent you can see the beginnings of this in the U.S. We've got a very polarized polity. We've got some pretty clear long-term fiscal challenges, and there's a kind of rigidity in the political discourse. It's not really permitting the political system to move ahead. Americans pride themselves in having a system of checks and balances, but I think in modern-day America, what the checks and balances amount to is, you know, very powerful lobbies that are able to veto certain kinds of reform in health care, in, you know, getting some hold over the budget deficit that, you know, make the system not very functional. I'm a long-term optimist, and so I think that eventually we're going to come out of this funk. But at the moment, I do think that the system is not serving us terribly well.
Francis Fukuyama, on that note, let me thank you for appearing on Late Night Live, and thank you for your time and for your book.
Thank you very much.
Francis Fukuyama, Oliver Nomalini, Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spolley Institute for International Studies at Stanford. His latest book's called The Origins of Political Order from Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution, a Profile Books publication.